When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Can none of y'all mirror me back? You hear me rap, it's like hand G rapping his prime. I'm young H.O. Raps Grateful Dead. Back to take over the globe.
Now welcome back to Miami Vice, a podcast all about the 2006 film Miami Vice. We are back after our deep cover hiatus. We are actually talking about Miami Vice this time. My amazing partner Blake Howard is here. Blake, how are you doing?
Katie, I'm in so deep, I almost forgot what it was like to be on this show. I'm so happy to be back. 2023 is exciting already for Miami Nice Heads. And I feel like over the holidays on our socials, on our Discord, people have been like frothing. And it's the season of Colin Farrell. It's just, people are just like, Colin Farrell this, Colin Farrell that. And we're just sort of lounging back on a banana lounger, wearing our Fiends for Mojito shirts, swilling rum mixes and smoking and going, ah, kids today, you guys wish you were on this bandwagon approximately 15 years ago, whatever it is, almost 20 years ago now. So yeah, I'm so excited to be back. We have some great guests.
Yes, we have some great guests. We have two guests today, one of whom, the first guest is my good friend Brandon Harris, who is a true Renaissance man. He's a writer, he's a former director of the Indie Memphis Film Festival, he's a filmmaker and a recovering film critic. Or do you identify as a recovering film critic, Brandon?
Recovering and often relapsed.
And often relapsed, okay. He wrote and directed the 2012 film Red Legs. He was a development exec at Amazon, working on Master, The Voyeurs, great erotic thriller, by the way, Blow the Man Down, and Time, excellent films. And he's the president of I'd Watch That, a company he co-founded with Shaka King, developing TV and film projects. And we also have Jason Jeffers, who is a filmmaker from Barbados, a fellow Caribbean native like me. I'm from St. Croix. He is the co-founder of the Miami-based Third Horizon Film Festival, which has been named one of the 25 coolest film festivals in the world by Movie Maker magazine. And he's currently producing a sci-fi film set in Miami and a documentary about the fight for reparations in Barbados. So, Brandon and Jason, thank you for being here.
Gentlemen. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having us. It's a real dream. And I have to thank you both for, you know, I can say you all helped get me through the pandemic.
Oh, Jason.
Yeah, truly.
It's the best thing ever. So thank you so much for listening. We have so much fun doing this. And we probably never thought we would talk this much about Miami Vice 2006. But we've turned this into the horniest modern Michael Mann campfire for your ears. So it's a pleasure. Now, Katie, I know a little story don't want to get too inside baseball. Katie has been an educator as well. Katie is obviously a fantastic and phenomenal film mind and film critic. And occasionally you and your very Renaissance man friend here, Brandon, are asked, as you know, people who've made films and people who've educated on films and people who have both been film critics, to come and give notes to emerging filmmakers, maybe friends, give me some ideas, tell me what you think of a cut of a film. Can you please tell the story of how this quartet conversation originated? Because I woke up with a bleary-eyed text, as I do often from Katie in my DMs on the other side of the world, and I had a hilarious story about completely derailing a viewing of a friend's film to talk nothing about the film, but everything about Miami Vice and everything about Michael Mann.
Yeah, I was with Brandon and another friend, Aman Abbasi, who we were supposed to go give notes on a friend's film, and we just sat around the table eating cheese and drinking wine and ranking Michael Mann films until our friend was like, okay, we have to start the screening now. But that was when Brandon was like, when am I going to be on the podcast?
In between chocolate-covered pretzels.
Yes.
I cannot stop talking about Miami Vice. And that's been the case for all of the 17 years or so since the movie came out. You know, it's evergreen.
Yes. And then you were like, we have to get Jason also on the podcast. So that is how this all came together. Just beautiful word of mouth, friends bringing friends together. So that's how it works. The inside baseball.
Fantastic. Gentlemen, I might start with Jason. So Jason, you said those lovely words about the shows that we've been doing. Can you tell us about your love of this very sweaty, very impressionistic, utterly freaking awesome film? Because I believe that both of you, apart from your love for it, Jason, you've actually had some experience with some of the locations that are in Miami Vice. So we'll eventually get to that. But can you tell us about your love of Miami Vice?
Oh, man. I have to admit, when I first saw the film, I was not the champion of it that I am now. I think I was too close to it. When it came out in 2006, I was previously a reporter at the Miami Herald. And I think the city of Miami, I think everybody in Miami had this collective, what the fuck? And I think with time, maybe when you first heard your voice as a kid recorded, right? Or maybe the first time you ever saw yourself on camera and you're like, that's me. And I think that was my reaction to the film. There are, no single film can encapsulate the entirety of a place, but it captured so much of it. But it captured it in a way that was, I think, a bit jarring to comprehend. And I have a big, long theory about this. I don't know if this is the moment to get into this, but, it was just, with time, the more, I spend so much time rewatching the film sometimes just looking at how he captured the Miami sky.
Yes.
I feel like, nobody else has quite gotten, there are a few films, I should say, that have really captured what a liminal space Miami is, the surreality of it all, so that's first and foremost what I love about it, is what I know about the city, things that I recognize, places that I see, it's, yeah.
And I love that sense. I don't know. I just love that phrase about the liminality of Miami. Like, absolutely. I haven't spent enough time there really. But that's such a fascinating concept. So
yeah, it's Miami is a pocket universe. It's not America. It's not Latin America. It's not the Caribbean. It's a pocket universe that exists at the intersection of all three of those places. And I think the film gets that, and it's not surprising to me that, Archangel de Jesus, I forget the name of, where his headquarters is, but it also
Ciudad del Este is where he's based. Yeah. On the tri-borders of Paraguay and Brazil.
Right. Like Miami's almost like a mirror of that. Right. In that, yes. It's a similar space where it is at the intersection of a bunch of places, but it's its own thing, there's a lawlessness, a frontier kind of energy to it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
I also come from a place like that. Right. And maybe that's why this movie like immediately appealed to me is, you know, people don't think of Cincinnati as a tri-state area, but it's really where like the West or the Midwest, the South and the East sort of converge, you know, at the Indiana-Kentucky border with Ohio is, you know, freedom or slavery. It's like a hinge point in America in many ways. And you know, when I first saw this movie, I was studying, I just left film school, and I had encountered the early French film theory term, photogenic, you know, the idea of a sort of expressionistic image that could capture the essence of a place just in the shot as opposed to in narrative. And when I think of movies that do that in contemporary times, Miami Vice is like near the top of the list. It's beyond how striking it looks. It also feels like a historical document in that movies will never look this way again.
Yes.
Yeah, totally. It's really of a time and place in a very specific way.
Yeah. And that moment in the middle aughts that, you know, you see the Viper camera and the early red and the way in which those kind of translate to being projected on a big screen, which is already kind of lost now, right? If you watch the movie on HBO Max on your computer, it's a vastly different experience than watching the theatrical cut or even the DVD of the director's cut with that remarkable boat chase that I'm glad was cut because it's like the later boat sequences have more of a grandeur because it doesn't sort of like, you know, shoot its wad at the beginning of the movie. But yeah, I that notion of like Miami being a this kind of, you know, tri-state, this meeting point between different cultures, Archangel's character being from that sort of Paraguay, Argentina, Brazil border and my own place in the tri-state area of Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana. I don't know. They seem to have some connection to me.
I love both those things of those liminal spaces, and Mann seems to be like obsessed with them. Like he, as a Chicago native, like loves LA for that very reason. Like he feels like it's a liminal space. It's always about travelers who have come there for some, whether it's, you know, economic reasons or it's, you know, work or whatever the case may be. And it's like that, I don't know, that seeking out of fortune. But I've never been to Miami either. And I'm kind of like, It feels like one of those bucket list places, and probably in a more like overt way. You used to think about it with things like New Orleans. You'd be like, oh, that's more of like a cultural melting pot just because of the makeup of the different cultures and ethnicities who sort of occupied that space earlier on in time. And that, as that has evolved, it's sort of got its own personality. But Miami is like you said, it's not only south because of its proximity, like, to the Southern American continent, but like the whole Cuban triangulation of Miami is another fantastic mixture of that. And you said something, Brandon, which I love, which is about like when we were trying to push the limits of digital photography, it was about expanding into the new planes that made whatever this new medium, this alternate medium to film was. It was about how different can it be from cinema that we've seen before, like 35 millimeter film. And then almost it like crests with Michael Mann in like 2006. And then in 2007, like David Fincher found the hack completely with Zodiac and made it look like a, not like something that had been stuffed in the Warner archives and then just pulled out from like 1976 or 74 or something like that. And just like thrown on a screen. And then ever since then, it was like, oh, how can we actually make digital go back to look like 35 mil? And that's what's sort of frustrating is you go like, no, what the purpose of this, the medium is like, what does this thing do to create a texture that is unique to not only the medium, but the place? And so it's like, I think of like Tangerine as another great film that I really enjoy of like using a medium and like, sort of puts a big exclamation mark on like, we're using something that's like an iPhone and it looks different. It's not film. But it's part of like the characters. And I think that Mann kind of gets that fusion of like, what is the texture of this movie? What is the aesthetic? And then what does it mean for the characters? And just like being unabashed with that. I think it's one of those films that rare ones that does it so like harmoniously.
Absolutely. Well
As filmmakers, are you guys like thinking, like, I mean, I imagine that you're talking about formats and digital and film and all this stuff. And like, what are these conversations that you're having and how might they be informed by our love of Michael Mann?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I was already a big fan of his before the film came out, and it threw me for such a whirl when it did. You know, again, like I was saying, it was so jarring. But it really kind of hit me to how, you know, not solely him, but just how much the format, the medium can be messed with to really capture. Because I have to get very woody woo about this.
Please do.
Get woody.
yeah. My chair keeps falling. He's with the format that he's using, it's almost like, as if he's puncturing a myth that he created. Because yeah. I think one of the things that often gets lost in the conversation, not just about the 2006 film, but also the television show, is that so much of modern Miami was created by the original television show.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So much of you know, when he came to Miami to make the show back then, so much of the glam, so much of the chic wasn't there yet. So much of that was created by the show. And then the city evolved to mirror the television show.
Wow.
And that's something which gets lost in conversation a lot. And I think even many of us, you know, in Miami, you know, we have a strained relationship with the television show. And I'm somewhat hesitant to say we in Miami, even though I've been there, what, like 25 years, worked for the newspaper, all these things. I'm not from Miami originally. But even still, you know, so many of us in Miami, when we talk about the TV show and just Miami Vice lore, you know, I mean, it feels like every 5 minutes there's like some, not as much recently, but there used to be, you know, be it the Design Preservation League having a symposium or a lecture about how much Miami Vice influenced the TV show, or the museum is doing an exhibition, or, you know, it's so much of the fabric of what the city is. And so then what he does with the film is it's like a meta-liminal loop-de-loop. Right. It's like he's puncturing the fabric, the mythology that he helped create, the veneer that he helped create, to say, well, what's behind this fantasy that I in turn helped create? So that when you come to that moment where Sonny is staring out over the horizon, you know, he's asking himself, within the context of the film, you get the impression that he's asking himself, well, what's real? What's really going on here? But if you look at that on a meta level, right, it's a character within a film that is itself referencing a constructed reality. So he's puncturing reality on two levels.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, it does.
So you have this character saying, well, what is real? And he is kind of burdened by so many levels of myth making and construction of reality. This is some Alan Moore shit. I'm sorry.
No, it's great.
I love that we just said this is some Alan Moore shit. Good. This is good.
Wait, no, I was, when I watched the film again recently, I recall that moment distinctly where they're talking to Eddie Marsan's character, who is doing this remarkable, like, North Florida, like, hick.
One of the great accents.
Like, remarkable accent. And it's just like an absurd scene. And the writing has this almost like Mimetian, like, ping pong quality, yes, between the cops as they're like intimidating him. And in the middle, it really has some like remarkable unintentional comedy. Like, there's a moment where Jamie Foxx Marsan says, they're vertically integrated. You know, and Jamie Foxx is like, what does that mean? They have an erection all day. And in the midst of that scene, like, it's almost like Sonny is tired of it. Like, he's like, what is my life?
Yes.
Yeah.
AUC, you know, Colombian right-wing paramilitaries, you know who they are. They are vertically integrated.
You mean they walk around with constant erections?
No. They farm, process, produce, export.
I know what it means.
No, see, it gives them attitude. A player negotiates too hard and you never hear from him again, because these guys kill everything. I gotta know what's the skinny.
It's none of your fucking business.
It can come back on me, baby.
Can't come back on you, baby.
I'm not sure of that.
Hey, Sunshine, when has Rico or Sonny ever lied to you? Huh? I mean, when has anything Rico told you not to happen exactly like he said?
You saying a lot to you?
No, I'm not saying
that. Yes, you are.
It's just his variables, you know? Randomness, see? That's why.
That's why what?
Well, why, like, if you can't deliver, this group goes from zero to high order violence like that.
You made a 15% commission off three money laundering prosecutions I put you into. You know, which is why you live in your $4 million condo and you question Rico and Sonny.
Oh.
Fuck that. I will cap your skanky ass and throw it off that goddamn balcony.
Yeah, then we can kick back and watch Marlon's highlights on this 65-inch plasma.
After we clean this place up. Don't you ever put anything away?
Plus, he's going to commission Jose Yero for putting you to Jose Yero.
And it's almost like an Antonio movie, a moment of an Antonio movie where he, like, you know, he's going to stare off and then we just, the sound drops out.
Yeah.
And we just get the horizon. And it's almost like resets you in reality amidst a movie that is, you know, a genre of fantasy.
Yeah.
And there are several moments like that throughout the film. The sequence in Havana is peppered with a couple of them. But
and even the John Hawkes opening. It's like here's all this action, here's all this frenetic craziness, kidnappings, undercover agents being shot and killed, like cripplingly tragic revelations that's, you know, his wife has been murdered by this Aryan Brotherhood. And then the movie just does this glacial kind of lean away from the actual narrative and just stares at the breeze in a windsock on a bridge and the music soars and you're like, this is like a massive inhale that is not necessarily about movement, propulsion. It's like it takes these little moments and then bang, we're back to the story again. And it feels like yeah, something really special about that. But I love what you both said just there in different ways. I had a great supervisor at university who helped me construct my like a thesis that I did when I was studying about Michael Mann. And when we were talking about Miami Vice, because we were talking about style and we're talking about authorship and stuff like that, like my homework assignment was, he's like, I made him watch Miami Vice with me. He's one of the first people Katie I forced to watch Miami Vice, I think, around the time that it was released. Because I was like, as Katie would say, I was Miami Vice pilled from like second one in the cinema. And so I was trying to show it to as many people as I could. And he watched it and he goes, you need to go and watch Antonioni. Like, he's like, Michael Mann feels like he's pulling from Antonioni so much. And yeah, I think what you said about that, like, Jason, you're talking about like that sort of sublime moment, like myth busting his own myth. There's this weird feedback loop that's happening with Miami Vice, because it's like Miami Vice looks a certain way that then and approaches narrative in a certain way that then has influence on cinema. And then it feels like it almost comes back around to like then influence almost all the way to like John McTiernan's Die Hard, especially in sort of action machismo movies. And then it flips right back around again to like, you know, film clips and Fincher and then Michael Bay and then like Bad Boys. And then we come back, we've come all the way back around and it just feels like they've put a filter on what Miami is through Bad Boys.
Right, right. Yeah, it's, you know, it's funny. I went back in preparing for this. I was so excited. I went back and I went into the Miami Herald archives to read just stories written about this, you know, about the lore. And most of the stuff I was able to find was about the TV show, not about the film. But it's interesting how those articles are relevant to the film in different ways.
Yes.
Like I found they quoted in one of the early Miami Herald articles, they in turn quoted an article that was in New York Magazine reviewing the first season of the TV show. And you read it and you like, wait, are they're talking about the TV show or are they talking about the movie? Because this writer, John Leonard, said it is, describing the first season of the TV show, mind you, he says that it was a surreal sandwiching of abstract art and broken mirrors and picture postcards. There is no murder, there is only art. seen through filters of psychedelic lollipop dissolved in montage, piled under by superimpositions of the ghostly and the slick. And you know, I think it's easy to forget just how much of a just how much the TV show changed everything, right?
Yes.
So it was almost like it was essential for Michael Mann to go into the film in that spirit and say, well, I have to change everything again, right? Like I have to be as revolutionary in my approach to this as I was in the making of the television show, you know, because to just replicate the television show, which is what everybody was expecting, and what certainly I think people in Miami were expecting, which is why the film kind of landed like a wet fart when it came out. Everybody was like, wait, this is not, you know, but again, puncturing that myth, you know, and this surreal kind of deconstruction, peeling back the layers of what that, you know, I mean, even Miami itself is a constructed space, right? Even Miami itself was always crazy that it's even a city. It's so young, so much younger than, you know, it's barely 100 years old. You compare that to most cities, you know, so many cities around the United States. So again, the layers of reality, like the city, like what is real about the city in real life, right? And then you have this TV show that comes along and creates this. I mean, there's stories about Michael Mann making the first season and flying in. You know, I found another article in the Herald and it was talking about a Miami Design Preservation League guy was saying that for the first season, Michael Mann flew in tropical fish from South Africa to put in an aquarium in the basement of an abandoned building on Miami Beach to make it look like a club, right?
That's so bad. You're not supposed to invite non-native species. That's how we get issues with lionfish, which like are huge issues in St. Croix. I don't know if it is in Miami, but it's like these really invasive species. Sorry, I'm just going off on a lionfish tangent.
I mean, look, it's award season. They're talking about tar. There's that great line that like Francis Ford Coppola in a scene that was cut out of Apocalypse Now took crocodiles to a part of the Philippines
yes!
and now you can't swim in the river because they just bred in the river and now they eat the natives, the people who actually live there. So, you know.
Okay, so he brought in these
fish. So I was just saying that he, you know, when you think about these uber luxurious nightclubs and the chic of Miami, so you have Miami itself as this kind of a very real place, but so much of the city was constructed, certainly Miami Beach, constructed as this tourist haven.
And they're saying, oh, we want to create this image that people have seen on TV.
Right.
And, you know, what are people expecting when they come here? They're expecting the, you know, hot, sexy clubs and the art deco and all that stuff. So they're like, it's like this self-fulfilling prophecy or something where it's like, oh, the media has created this image and now we're going to create ourselves in the image of this media and feeding into each other. And then you get something like the movie where it's like, whoa, we're like in a Aryan Brotherhood trailer park. Like that's not what we
thought.
Not on a postcard.
Right. And there's so much in the city that, you know, the film excited me and continues to excite me because I think it, there aren't that many great films made about Miami and there's so much more to be made. And it, you know, that's where people like me and Brandon come in, you know?
Yeah.
To think about what can you tell of the city that hasn't been told before, you know?
Right. When did you come around to the film? Like you initially saw it, you were thrown back by it, but like how did you sort of come around to like appreciating it in such an interesting philosophical way as you do?
Well, you know, years ago, I started thinking about, you know, I've been in the States for 25 years now. And, you know, I'm currently making a film about Barbados and I advocate for Caribbean filmmakers. But I increasingly over the years started thinking about my longing for home, my longing to go back to the Caribbean. And it's funny. I started thinking about the scene with Sonny looking out over the horizon, but then also thinking about how there's similar scenes in some of Mann's other films, you know, in say Manhunter, you know, the the Will character. He's not necessarily looking out over the horizon, but the kind of idyllic beach setting that he's in at the beginning of the film before he's called back into the field. I started just thinking about the moments in Michael Mann films where he captures that, where he captures this kind of desire to escape from the rat race. And because of that, it made me go back to Miami Vice again. I mean, it created a bit of a mini existential whirlpool inside myself, because I'm like, okay, he has these characters who are longing for this place, and I'm longing for that place too, but I'm actually from there. So what does that mean? But, you know, I don't know. I just think that scene with Sonny looking out over the horizon, it's one of my favorite moments in all of film, honestly. It captures something which is so true to just my experience.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, thinking about that scene, it's funny, even though I had dismissed the film for a while there, that scene popped up in my head, I don't know, I want to say maybe 5-6 years later. And then certainly, you know, the work that you all have done, and you know, I think, you know, I've seen some writing that Bill J. Berry did for, I guess, was it New York Magazine? Or I don't know, yeah. Just as the kind of reassessment of the film happened. It was like, oh, wait, so I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one. Like, okay, all right.
Yeah.
Okay. It's safe. It's safe to talk about this. We can talk.
Bill Yer is the true acolyte. He's the man acolyte. He's the best. He writes that. There's almost no one better who writes about Michael Mann than Bill Yer. He's, yeah, and great friend of the show. Brandon.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. I was going to ask the same question to Brandon, if you were always Miami Vice-pilled.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay. My experience with Miami Vice as a movie is really interesting, because I was actually in a very, like, mournful place when I first saw this film. My great aunt had passed away, who used to, like, babysit me and stuff and taught me to play poker. And I got this news on the way to see Miami Vice.
Oh, no.
I actually had to pull over. I remember I was on the BQE, and I had like a collect myself, and I was like, am I gonna still go see this movie? And I was like, yeah, go see it. And I saw Miami Vice alone at the Regal UA in Union Square in New York. And I was immediately transfixed with the movie. I was already sort of like a man fan, obsessed with Heat and the last the Mohicans. And I think I'd been somewhat disappointed by Collateral, which is a movie I've since maybe come back to a bit. That was one that had to be reclaimed for me.
Mm-hmm.
But from the jump, I was working against the critical consensus on Miami Vice. And indeed, for those that remember, that critical consensus was that this movie was trash.
It's still rotten on Rotten Tomatoes. Yeah. It's like a 40 something. I have to look and see.
I just remember that weekend talking to people about it, and people.
Can
just
we post me? Every one of these episodes as a review with our guests' names on Rotten Tomatoes, Katie, and then just have like a list and just turn the critical tide? I think there's some way we could do that. That we have to.
We have to get our podcast Tomato Meter approved.
Yeah. Well, look.
It is a 47. It's currently a 47 on Rotten Tomatoes.
How unjust. But, you know, an early proponent of the movie, like, I remember, this is 2007 or 2008, there was a piece in Senses of Cinema by a guy named Jean-Baptiste
Thoray.
Right?
We
had him on the show.
He's incredible.
Miami Vice in the Flux or something.
Gravity in the Flux.
Yeah. And I remember reading that and being like, yes, people see that there is like art in this movie, that like there is, you know, and from the jump, I was like, oh, the movie kind of has this texture that I haven't seen. And I found its unique sort of juxtaposition again of these like kind of absurd moments of writing, like almost like cringeworthy moments of writing that nonetheless like have this potent kind of, postmodern quality to them, you know, mixed with like utter gravity of the bits of humor, the virtuosic filmmaking, to be something that I think we now kind of associate with Korean cinema to a degree, with so there's a certain kind of sophisticated language to talk about movies like that now. But I feel like in 2006, especially with the veneer of a Hollywood blockbuster that cost $100 million and is being marketed in the way the movie was being marketed, people just had no idea what the fuck they were getting into.
Right.
And they panicked in the midst of that. I feel like there are people that, in fact, if they were watching the movie under a different name, in a completely different circumstance, would have responded favorably to the movie.
Oh, I think that's totally, totally, because it's working. Like Jason has said, like everyone has all this baggage from the show of what they're expecting from the show. And I also think the context is so important because, like I've said this before, but I think people were expecting like a Starsky and Hutch. Because that was what was going on at the time, like rehabbing these.
And the Dukes 80s, of Hazzard.
The Dukes of Hazzard, like rehabbing these Charlie's 80s shows. Angels. Yeah, to be funny, you know, thrill, like more comedies than anything else. And I think it's really interesting that you talk about the way that like that there are all these disparate elements. Like it's almost like the dialogue is like in conflict with like the style. Because when I first saw this movie, which I have to admit was not in the movie theater, it was in a grad school class, thanks to Todd Boyd. And I was like laughing the whole time at the dialogue, but yeah, as I've, you know, watched it over and over again, it's like, it's such a mournful film. It's a, like you, I think I stole that word from you, Brandon, like it's such a longing. There's so much emotional existential pain going on in this film that you can't help but be like completely shattered and heartbroken at the end of it.
It's about people wanting, like yearning for greater connection with each other on some level, in a way that watching again, it's, that's the granular subject of like a lot of the scenes in this movie. The ones that aren't, I mean, there's plenty of scenes that are just like advancing the plot. And yet the movie is kind of bookended by Ricardo being asked to take care of Leonetta on behalf of the John Hawks character, Orlando. And then they have that haunting moment together where he reveals that Leonetta has been killed, and but he doesn't reveal it.
You don't need to go home.
He says, I gotta go home. He's like, no, you don't
go. You don't. You don't, you don't need to go home.
They said they wouldn't hurt.
They lied.
And now is a quick break to hear from our sponsors.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
You don't gotta go home. You know, you don't need to go home. And then, you know, so much of the content of the third act is, in fact, Naomi Harris's character being the woman in peril. And there's this remarkable moment late in the film where Sonny is sitting and listening to Jamie Foxx, and he says something to the effect of, "I can't believe she almost lost her life over this shit, man."
That time. Yeah. Badges get flashed, guns come out, rest get made. That's what we do.
So?
So, fabricated identity, and what's really up, collapsed into one frame. You ready for that on this one?
I absolutely am not.
So why are you ever there?
I'm with her 100%.
She could be a white-collar money manager. She may even be true love. But she's with them.
Trudy would say, I ain't playing.
Like in this very like flat and incredibly powerful way, when you think back on Sonny's own thoughts of like whether any of this is worth it, his own attraction to the Gong Li character, Isabella, and their like kind of desire to transcend the nature of this cops and robbers, drug dealers, yeah, and federal agents, you know, plot that we're in. And it's almost like the movie constantly wants to like
escape the plot.
Escape that, right. Escape the confines of right. The thing that it has to deliver.
Right.
So that it can exist. You know, and so there's that question of like restlessness that you find throughout Mann's films, right? That's like a constant subject of these fucking restless men that just like wish they could find a home with a woman, but they gotta be out in the world fucking shit up, you know? And it's like, and this is like the apotheosis of it. I mean, it's just like, it's screaming from all the scenes if you're like looking for it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. That's
well, that's part of like why people sometimes will be like, the plot's confusing. And it's like, no, like it's just vibes. Like, ignore the plot, just vibes. Like,
yeah, no, I feel like so much of this film hinges on a dance, the dance, whether on a cosmic level or just on the very real dance between Gong Li and Colin Farrell, and how all of the characters in the film are forced to confront that, to reevaluate themselves. Everything is either now going to collapse or come together because of this, right? Because all of these people have been dealing in different levels of artifice, you know, are trapped in careers that maybe they didn't ask for, be they a cop, be they you know, a trafficker, but all of a sudden this moment of real passion throws everything into some kind of existential crisis, you know.
Such is the power of that dance.
And I love that when Jose Hierro sees it, it's on the CCTV footage, so it's like mediated through all of these layers,
right,
of digital artifice in a way. And yeah, it's like we are him watching them within the realm of watching. So it's like all of this voyeuristic, interesting, puncturing layers of media that we're dealing with.
We're all wanting to be Gong Li's. We're all wanting to be Gong Li's boyfriend, just like Jose Hero.
that dance is a metaphor for the dance at the center of all the multiverses, right?
that
is the center of the.
Where's that everything everywhere all at once, right? You know what I mean? Just Colin Farrell and Gong Li.
Yeah, oh my God. Wait, can that be the sequel?
Five stars.
Like, I just
five
wanted
stars
to
on
do
casting.
Laundry with you.
Forever.
I just wanted to traffic drugs with you forever. wait, so Jason, are there any other like fun when you're watching the film and you're like, wait, I know where that is, or like that looks totally different, like any other fun like Miami native insights to watching this film?
Well, I mean, I you know, the driving scene, you know, again at the very beginning of the film, driving down 95, I mean, there was a point in time, I believe that scene is either, it's definitely like lower than 79th Street. It's like somewhere between 79th Street and Brickell, a particular stretch of I-95, which I've driven a lot, and which I know at some point in time, I'm not sure exactly when, but at some point in the last 20 years, it was the deadliest stretch of roadway in America.
Whoa.
Yeah, there were so many accidents that were happening there. I think it's the energy of the film. The energy of the film, you know, I often say that Miami is the most desperate place in America. And I hate reducing it to these things because it's so much more than, again, that can be captured in one film. But I think part of the energy of Miami is, you know, you have so many people coming from different parts of, you know, like I you know, emigrated there from the Caribbean, from South America, from all over the world, really. And it is their point of entry into America, right? And it's their first shot at the American dream, if that is a real thing, or if it's not, that's a topic for another podcast. I know where I land on that, but again, I digress. But then you have so many people, you know, coming, I was going to say washing up there from other parts of the United States, and it's their last shot at the American dream. And so it leads to this kind of really desperate energy, right? Like this real it's a frontier town in many ways, and it always has been. And
there's probably a sense of lawlessness.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Anthony Yerkovich, who like created the you know, the TV show with Michael Mann, I mean, but it starts with Yerkovich, you know. The thing that inspired him, you know, the MTV cop story often gets thrown around about, you know, somebody writing that on a napkin. But even before that, what he was inspired by was the fact that in the 80s, 20% of all unreported income in the United States came from Miami, meaning that 0.5% of the country's population was responsible for 20% of the country's under the table money.
Huh.
Right. So that just tells Jesus. You, and that has always kind of been the truth of the place, right? Is that it is its own world. And yeah, I think that the film, not in the cops and robbers thing, because, you know, I, you know, certainly have my own issues about worshiping a film that valorizes cops, but I don't think it does valorize cops, actually.
Yeah.
I don't think it does at all. I think, you know, we're seeing these characters confront the limitations of their job and going for something beyond that. But I think the energy of the film transcends crime, law, cops, robbers, all of these things, to capture this place where you're forced to confront. It's a place where that's almost in a permanent existential crisis, right? Like, I always like to say that Miami has the front row seats to the apocalypse, because whether it's, you know, like whether it's sea level rise or, you know, mass immigration, like Miami is on the front lines of so many of the issues that the United States is confronting, right? Mm-hmm. And the film very much taps into that energy. It infuses every single frame of it, right? Of these characters navigating this place where anything can happen and probably will.
You know, I want to ask you guys, because I, you know, went from Australia, when we launched this podcast, it was like right in the throes of the first wave of the pandemic. And we've since gone on and the world's opened up and travel's possible again. But I remember at the time, you know, doing this show, talking to Katie, talking to our friends, Miami, from a way, way outsider's perspective, was such a fascinating entity because it was like not only a city, but a state of Florida became this place that was like, we are not prescribing to any of the medical advice or the designations that this is a pandemic, this is happening. And it was one of those things where like people flocked to Miami for that very thing of, we're kind of like morally, very morally ambivalent place of like, no, you can come down here and we'll still be open and we'll still make money. And people like flocked there, did things. The pandemic came and went. But I feel like Miami as a case study almost like underscored some of the like great moral quandary that this movie talks about, which is just like it exists and we are living by our own rules. And there are no rules in Miami. There's like no rules. You're going to come down here and live. And I feel like that happened. And then now, like as we reach 2023 and, you know, the world from that perspective is sort of stabilized, I wonder if like the entire makeup of the city has changed or evolved again because of like that. Again, like you said, this like it was a nexus for people just flooding to the southern states to go and live their lives a certain way during the pandemic that like other places just didn't operate that way.
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, the stepping back outside after being in lockdown for, you know, year, 2 years, so much of the city changed during the pandemic. The overdevelopment was out of control. There was a severe population boom. Miami has one of the worst housing crises in the country right now. It's a bit sad, but you know, the thing that I remind myself is that this has been a part of what the city always was.
Yeah.
Yeah. In many ways, the city is greater than the sum of its parts. I think the city is, the conflict at the heart of Miami is always what is actually there, right? Which is this incredible collision of cultures, people from all over the Caribbean, South America, you know, the Southern United States, and this imposed industrial chic, industrial sexy, sophisticated kind of thing that has kind of gone into mass overdrive over the last 2 years with this influx of money and people. And I think that increasingly that lawlessness is being there are only certain people who are able to get away with that. Increasingly, it feels like, right? Like, because a lot of people are being pushed out, right? And so the beautiful parts of Miami, I don't know, I hope this isn't getting too philosophical or whatnot, but I mean that energy, that spirit is something that I love about Miami, right? It's you know, the things that you can experience there as, you know, like it's such a Caribbean city, right? Like I can experience aspects of Caribbean culture there in a way that I can't experience anywhere else in the United States, right? To some degree, New Orleans, but, you know, but increasingly because of the gentrification, because of the development, a lot of that is being pushed out. So while it is still a lawless free-for-all, to some degree, for whom?
Yes. You know?
That's a good point. Yeah.
Is it like Bitcoin bros and,
you know, yeah.
Like if it's just them, then that's a problem.
Those Bitcoin bros, they're all vertically integrated by the same, right, by the, right. from the outside. Brandon,
swag.
No.
I'm curious. Do you feel like there's aspects of a past Miami that you can see in this 17-year-old film that has been a victim of what you're describing at all?
I don't know. There's a scene. Yeah, I mean, I feel as if there's certainly a lot more high rises. It's becoming more of a condo canyon. I mean, there's that Solange song, you know, Cranes in the Sky, which was actually inspired by a trip that she took to Miami, apparently. I mean, there are more cranes in the sky than ever. I mean, my apartment, I'm by coastal these days. Right now I'm recording in California, but I go back and forth between Miami. Like my apartment in Miami is not far from Overtown, which is there are one or two scenes shot there.
Yeah, the safe house is in Overtown. Where
the safe house is in Overtown.
And they've stolen his drugs and are acting like they found them.
Mm. Yes.
Right.
I remember when I saw that scene, it's like, that's the first time we see an Art Deco building.
Yes.
And in disrepair. And it's this, you know, black part of Miami that, you know, we don't associate with the show, per se, or with like the image of of Miami that the show, as you suggested, then cultivated a certain kind of Miami. But I couldn't help but think this time around watching it, like, oh, I wonder if that's been gentrified. You know, like,
yeah, well, I was going to say, you know, like that safe house is about 15 blocks from my apartment. I don't expect that my apartment is going to be around. I don't think I'm going to have it more than another year. Because of the development that's happening in the neighborhood, they're high rises. Like, my apartment is a two-story building, in a two-story building, and their high rises going up on either side of it. It's about to become the house from Up. and I think that, you know, I don't think my landlord, he really believes in preservation. I don't think that is long for the world. He's already told me, he's like, yeah, I don't know how long I'm going to be able to fight off these developers. And so places like the safe house, you know, That's a popular location. You see it in many different Miami films and TV shows and whatnot. But that's probably not long for the world. So I think, yeah, places like that are certainly... I watch the film and I'm like, yeah, this really is an important document because much of this will not exist much longer.
There's a city in Australia, Brisbane, which is in Queensland, one of our northern states. And unlike Sydney and Melbourne, for folks internationally that you've heard of, like, there are still parts of Sydney that are old and still parts of Melbourne that are old. Like, there's like industrial flavors, times past where buildings have been preserved and they've been on, conservation lists and stuff like that. So you can sort of gut the insides out of them, but the original facades and things like that have to stay the same. And Brisbane doesn't have that ethos. Brisbane, I think famously, they say that it gets leveled every 10 years and then new high rises go up. Like, it has no personality because it's just like someone that's constantly getting cosmetic surgery. Like, it doesn't have, there's no sense of what old Brisbane used to look like because they just level it. But yeah, I feel like that's, you know, that's a tragedy that we, you know, everyone is just dealing with right now in all of the contemporary, you know, major cities, because it's just like, how do we increase population? How do we keep gentrifying and, like, you know, these bland, utterly bland contemporary buildings just keep popping up and they take away all the personality, or like their mere imposition is like immediately disrupts the culture that made that spot amazing once.
I think drawing on everything we've talked about this episode, like, it just seems to me like we started off talking about Miami as a liminal space, and that it seems like you kind of have to, there's like a constant churn of existential crisis that is like maybe reflected in the landscape. It's a young city, and it sort of seems like you kind of have to be okay with the shifting sands of time, which I think is reflected in this film and also reflected in, I think, a lot of Michael Mann's work, and that, you know, just that sort of poignancy of like being okay with non-attachment and constant change. And I also think like the environment has something to do with that too. Like, you can't be too attached to something if a hurricane's going to come through.
Yes.
I just think it's just all of these philosophical themes and ideas about time and change and existentialism, I think, are like so beautiful to talk about, even though there is a deep sort of like sorrow and sadness behind it as well.
Yeah, I think the film and the city and all of these things ask you to, you know, identify with that churn at the center of it all, right? To be the eye of the hurricane, to be the, what is the eye of the hurricane, or the dance at the center of it all, right?
Yes, the eye of the hurricane is the salsa dance at the center.
Now, Brandon, do you feel the necessity? Because as Katie pointed out, this movie still devastatingly only has 47% on Rotten Tomatoes. Could we ever convince you to relapse back into film criticism just to just to post a review of Miami Vice to get, you know, help bump those numbers back up, those rookie numbers of 47, this travesty and right or wrong that is a blot.
I am certainly open to it. I'm certainly open to it. I haven't had the occasion to write about this movie yet, but perhaps it will occur in the future. I would love to get it over 50%.
That's,
I could be that person to you.
That's the goal.
Right. Here's what we need. There's been a proliferation, as Blake, as you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, of people standing Colin Farrell and then saying, oh, have you heard of this movie, Miami Vice? And as I like to say, every time an article is published on some website where they like reappreciate Miami Vice and don't mention our podcast, we go stronger and more powerful.
This is the other thing, and it's not even about the podcast. It's just about people writing the same article that Kim Masters wrote more than a decade ago over and again without any of the like. And thank you so much to all the listeners and contributors and supporters of this show. Like, we've myth-busted so many things. Like, if you just listen to the Japhet Gordon episodes, you could write a pretty sexy article. And one that would probably get quite a few clicks, because I can imagine an SEO title for some of the revelations that came up in that double episode would be pretty spicy indeed. But it's just like, for the love of God, if you're going to write about Miami Vice, just listen to a couple of the episodes with people we've spoken to, like Elliot Koretz, who was a sound designer, and one of the planes like flying and almost buzzing him with a propeller. Like, come on, like, just add some detail that actually means something. If you, God,
I know these people are only getting paid $25 to write, hey, check out Miami Vice.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough.
Where is the memoir from Colin Farrell's rehab counselor in the wake of Miami Vice? You know, that's the holy grail. That's where all the secrets are, where the bodies are buried.
Oh my God. So, mail@oneheatminute.com. mail@oneheatminute.com.
Yes. Well, I'm just crossing my fingers that I cross paths with Colin during award season so that I can just be like, hey, Colin.
In that shirt, in your Miami Nice,
yes,
theme for mojito shirt, you must immediately get that. Guys, before we wrap up, let's start with you, Brandon. Was there anything else that, and casting our minds way back to eating chocolate-covered pretzels and talking about Michael Mann rankings with Katie, is there any other stuff that, you know, is still like deeply resonant for you? Because I feel like we're all in that nexus point, that gravity of the flux moment from Jean-Baptiste Leray, of like Colin Farrell looking out the window and having these existential crises. But any other moments, like favorite moments and things like that, that resonate with you, not only as a person who's previously recovering from being a film critic, but like as a film producer, something that you would assign, like, go, okay, just watch this scene, not this, not the whole movie.
I just love how consistently surprising certain characterizations are in the movie. That was something that occurred to me this last time watching it. So for instance, when we first meet Montoya, he's the most polite guy in the movie.
Yeah, by far.
He's such a like sweetheart. He's like, I hope your families are well and that we never see each other again and we all get very rich. And you know,
Katie, we
like,
should really close the show like that from now on.
You want him to like come over for dinner, you know, like. And then later, there's this remarkable moment. Like this, I would say that in general, like Michael Mann's movies are like sex positive movies.
Oh yeah.
I would also say that this is perhaps a sex positive movie. But one thing that I find so interesting about the relationship between Montoya and Isabella is that sense that like we feel like when she first chooses to run off with Colin Farrell, oh, maybe she's really off the reservation here. Like this is going to be the rift. Only to have that remarkable scene where they're together and he's like, so should we kill this guy or should we keep working with them? And she's like, well, you know, I had sex with him in Cuba and they're reliable, but like you could kill him. I don't know. But And you're like, is she like working him in that moment? Like by saying like, yo, I fucked him and you can kill him.
Right, right, right.
But I don't want you to kill him. So by me saying that you can, it shows that I'm still loyal to you. And then there's that moment right after the scene ends with an implied, you know, the beginning of a sexual act between them.
Right.
And it just provides this remarkable complexity to the characters that, like, you feel like you understand what's happening between them and amidst them, and then it deepens and is complicated. And that happens throughout the movie in a way that I think is, that I'd maybe forgotten to an extent in the, you know, 6 or 7 years since I
love that moment where he's got the international news on. And it's got all the stock prices on the ticker on the television. And she tells him that story and he's reading a paper and his eyes don't even come up. She's like, I slept with him in Miami or I slept with him in Cuba. And he's like, and like, he just doesn't, like, maybe there's a fleck of emotion that crosses his eyes. But Louis Tozer, who plays Archangel de Jesus Montoya, I just love, I'm like, that's a baller. Like, your girl just told you
an unflappability that we all wish we could, you know,
a control, yeah, a control, a level of just like, and okay, yep, all right,
yeah,
we'll do one more deal with him, we'll see how it goes.
But yeah, I mean, that's one aspect, and yeah, I don't know, I forgot how funny the movie was, weirdly, up in points, and I never really connected the theme of home or inability to find a home, to find the, like, a sort of stability amidst this this imperiled city, this lethal line of work that feels, you know, somewhat pointless. Like at this point in his career, Mann has made several movies that kind of show you both sides of a criminal element, right? Or like the sense, obviously, in Heat that the cops and robbers are, but, you know, two sides of the same coin. Like, that's a theme he's visited before. But this was the first time where I felt like maybe he's saying, like, these characters are more relevant than the circumstances they're in.
Yes.
And the way he chose to say that amidst what was, at that point, the biggest movie of his career, yeah, I just think it's really laudable. It's an unusual thing in film history, actually.
So. I mean, the film really speaks to this idea that there is something beyond all of this. And I think one of the strange ways that he does it, it's a blink and you'll miss it moment, is the fact that Gong Li's character, you know, she mentions that her mother was in Angola.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, Michael Mann has this concern with the third world, which is, again, this kind of blink and you'll miss it thing. It's there in the director's cut of Ali as well, right? The scenes that got cut from the theatrical version have to do with the murder of Patrice Lumumba, president of the Congo, right? So his politics, you know, on the surface, you may think, oh, this is, you know, a propaganda movie, but it's, you know, Gong Li's character is the daughter of somebody who was reaching for a life beyond imperialism. And these, you know, when Colin Sonny talks to her about maybe meeting up with her at some point after they've escaped all of this, right? Is he just talking about the case? Or is he talking about the current world order, right? Is he talking about third world utopia? I like to think he is. You know what I mean? Like, I like to think he is. Like, what are these, you know, this geopolitical maze that they're trapped in and are forced to act out certain roles on this chessboard, and they're trying to escape that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I think the last place that you would expect to find an entry point into a conversation about the Angolan war is a Miami Vice movie, but it's there. It's there, you know. Yes.
I love that Michael Mann Easter eggs are like these little moments of like, oh, he's actually talking about like colonialism and geopolitical issues. And like, because I love finding those little things too in his work where it's like, oh, he's like interested in this place that is like a convergence of cultures, right. Even if it's not like, obviously Miami is like the major one of that, but even like the Ciudad del Este little journey, and the way he goes back there in Heat 2, and referencing, yeah, like, you know, her background and as a Chinese Cuban person, and Angola, and all these little, it's like, those are the little things you have to find in Michael Mann movies, are his little political comments.
I like Easter eggs like that, and I hate Easter eggs that introduce new fucking Marvel characters. Like, who gives a shit? Who cares?
Right. Well, I was actually thinking about that with, like, the, when we were talking about the nature of this being such a, like, resistant sequel, or I don't know what to call it, reboot. Like, everybody wants a legacy sequel now where they can go, it's that guy, it's that guy. Like, I call it, like, pointing at the screen, which, like, I saw the new Ghostbusters.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yes.
Leonardo, hey.
Yeah. So, like, when I saw, like, the new Ghostbusters legacy sequel, there was a girl in front of me who just spent the whole time, like, pointing at the screen at, like, the marshmallow guy and, like, various other things. I'm like, no, I hate pointing cinema, like, if that's what this is. But it's like, you know, Mann completely went the opposite direction in Miami Vice. Like, you're waiting to go, where's the crocodile? And there's no crocodile.
There's no crocodile.
So he's resisting that so much and being like, no, I need you to think about all of these other issues and, like, have an existential crisis at the same time. And also, it's not propaganda. Like, we talked about this a lot in June of 2020. Because I was sort of wrestling with, you know, covering this movie, but, like, I think this movie is just, like, there's nothing about the police that is, like, valorized here.
Right,
that is
right.
Glorified.
Right.
It's like, this looks like it sucks.
Yeah.
And everyone's having an ethical quandary and trying to escape being a police officer and going so deep undercover that you forget your identity as a police officer.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I just want to give one small shout out to, you know, the love scene between Naomi Harris and Jamie Foxx. I mean, the last place that I, you know, there was black cinema that, you know, and there was a lot more black cinema in the 90s, I feel like, early 90s, like, say, Love Jones, and, you know, where you had, the last place I would have expected to see a black love scene with India Arie playing.
That's very right? True.
That was the last, you know. And I'm just, you know, always struck when I rewatch it, just by how tender that scene is, you know. You know, even from the shower scene, you know, right before. Is there anything more tender than the little slap on the back to, hey, turn around, let me soap up your back? You know, like, it's just a beautiful little moment, you know. It's so human. It's so real. Yeah,
and it's real. The joke.
And I first started talking about this movie in reference to the Gong Li sex scene,
yes,
as well, while eating covered pretzels, which, in my mind, is like one of the most remarkable sex scenes in the movies too.
The tears in her in the corners of her.
Yeah, we're crying as they're walking on the bed. Oh. It's just breathtaking, yeah. Breathtaking stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Most romantic getaway ever when he puts her seatbelt on. And then he's like, I'm going to rev it up to 120 miles per hour.
Yeah. The fact that the film is just asking you to feel something, right? As the world is becoming just so much more, we're spending so much time, you know, thank you for technology, because we wouldn't be having this session right now were it not for that, right? But as we just kind of get so much more hemmed in by the grid that the characters are trying to escape. It's almost like they're, you know, in those moments, they're trying to show us a way out, right? A vortex out, to really just feel something, you know?
All we just gotta do is get that speedboat, Jason.
Yeah.
We're getting cramped down in emails and film finance.
Yeah,
I'll get the speedboat from Sydney, shoot it across the Pacific, pick up Katie on the way. And we'll come over to Third Horizon.
Love to be on a speedboat.
Fly over to Third Horizon. That would, you know, it'd be in the top five of the 25 coolest film festivals of all time if you rode in on a freaking Miami Vice speedboat. That would be the best.
Oh my God. Let's do it at Third Horizon.
I feel like there should be like a Miami Nice, like, live podcast recording. Miami, you know.
Let's talk. We can make something happen. We can make something happen.
Yeah. This is where it gets real. This is where dreams become a reality. No, Yeah, genuinely, we've actually.
Let's make something happen. Let's make it happen.
I feel like I need to go to Miami and do the, like, do the scouting tour of whatever still exists, Jason. Of like whatever still exists, go around, walk the streets, go to a nightclub, order a mojito, flirt with a waitress. Yeah. You know, like make my friends laugh. It feels like it's, you know. Katie's probably been able to do that in her life, but I haven't been able to do that yet. So it's definitely on a bucket
list.
We'll
get you there. We'll get you there. I am committing to that.
Oh, wow. Wow.
We are recording this on Wednesday, January the 18th.
Heard it here first.
You heard it here first. Yeah. Wow. Scary and exciting. Guys, I want to say, look, thank you so much. You've mixed the, you've run the Miami Nice Gauntlet, which is to be incredibly thoughtful, incredibly inspiring in your like depths of understanding and relatability of this movie, but also get to be a little bit pervy with Katie and I, which we deeply appreciate. And so thank you so much. Thank you just so much. And we're just so happy that if any of what we do connects with people, especially about this movie that gives us so much joy, that's a real treat, I think. Brandon, thank you for clipping Jason's belt in the speedboat of this podcast invitation.
My pleasure, man.
Jason's beautiful hair whipping in the breeze, looking at you.
Yeah, man. No, well, thank you. Thank you too for you know, the ongoing work. It is such a treat for me always. And thank you, Brandon, for bringing me as your plus one to the party.
Well, I was just going to say thank you, guys. And Brandon, I'm just so glad we connected about this at that screening last fall. But it would have happened eventually. It was inevitable.
You got some good notes. Four chocolate-covered pretzels and a beer only. So, you know.
He got some good notes from us. I'm going to say he got some good notes.
Yeah, no. Bless you guys for doing that. That makes that really heartening for me that you guys are doing that. I've got a dear friend who's just made a short film, and I was one of the first people to watch it. So I had that little mini experience, and I'm so excited for people to see her short. So, but yeah, great stuff. Love it. Thank you guys for being a part of the show. Everyone listening, thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you on another episode of Miami Nice, and who knows. We might be flailing open our legs and crying just a little bit, but we'll be sexual and tender with you as always.
See you in Miami.
All of the joy and the pain, and all the time that it takes just to stay in your good grace. Lately I've been thinking maybe you're not ready for me. Maybe you think I need to learn maturity. They say watch what you ask for, 'cause you might receive. Ask me tomorrow, I'll say the same thing. I am ready for love. Would you please lend me your ear?
You know, and it feels like such a 20th century movie. It feels like something David Lean would have done or tried to do. When he still had that kind of currency, and even then he might not have succeeded.
It's incredible, because like if you don't have time to watch all five seasons of Lost, you can just watch Fearless.
Not a week goes by that I don't think of the ending of Gallipoli. It's left a mark. A year of living dangerously, you know, and then something like Last Wave, even, that's so deeply embedded with the land and the story of the land, the story of place. You know, I don't know that I'd seen very many movies at that point in my life that had such a down ending, and they had such a, you know, sort of strong sense of folklore attached to it as that. And something always so poetic and lyrical about Peter Weir's work?
Gallipoli was the first movie that ever traumatized me, and I don't think I ever really recovered from it. And I'm still upset that they played it in school. Like, I don't think it's actually possible to make an... They say it's not possible to make an anti-war movie, but I think Peter Weir pulled it off.
Yes.
Because no one watches that movie then thinks, I want to go to war.
Peter Weir is the greatest director that Australia has ever produced. Like, bar none, hands down. Like, no one else has even... in the room.
I think you have covered some really titanic filmmakers and some really titanic films so far, but I truly think what makes Peter Weir special and what makes you doing this one special is we don't talk about Peter Weir that way, and we should. Peter Weir is one of those guys who I don't get why he isn't a bigger name, why he isn't more in that rarefied air.
Yes.
Because I think film for film, he's one of our very best filmmakers. He has brought his A game repeatedly to many properties. There are films of his that I hold very dear. Fearless, The Mosquito Coast. I will fight somebody if they talk bad about The Mosquito Coast. It's, man, I love that movie. But in general, I just think he is a special filmmaker, a smart, lyrical, hallucinatory filmmaker. He's a very dreamy filmmaker, and I don't think he gets his due.
You know, Master and Commander is one of my all-time favorite movies. Easily one of the best movies of the last 20 years. It's, it's a grand scale. There's a historical backdrop to it. But at the same time, there's such an intimacy in the relationships.
Which I think is not just a great film and one of the last great epics in the truest sense. I think is actually kind of a sliding doors change point moment. In cinema history. I think 2003, when that comes along, and it is an old-fashioned, we don't make them like that anymore type film. I think if Master and Commander spawns a franchise at that point, the entire cinema landscape globally is completely different.
That's the movie that I wanted to see 10 of those, I know they're big fans of Fast and Furious and everything, and God bless you, but Master and Commander should have been.
It's one of those things. Again, I'm not a seafaring man, sir. But there is a sense of authenticity. There's a sense of really watching a genuine dedication to recreating history unfold on a big screen in front of you that can't help but inspire just genuine admiration and awe.
If you're gonna pick a film where he really brings every one of his skills to the table, it's Master and Commander. I think you picked the right one, man.
Yeah, very excited to see what you pull out of this, Blake.
That's right. Our next series is Peter Weir and Russell Crowe's Master and Commander. The series is called Podcaster and Commander.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.